like exercising stealing your thunder. I've had a most wonderful couple of weeks. Let me say, first of all, thank you for your welcome, Karen, but thank you, all of you, for making me so welcome in this fellowship. And, okay, I won't stay very near it, whatever happens. So. But the mobile one I don't think is working. I tend to move around. But I've had a great blessing from having to speak about the story. I say having to. I wasn't told I had to. I was offered the chance of speaking either on John, a section of John's Gospel, which Claire, thank you. You see, I have terrible trouble with names. You all know me because I'm Michael's father, and I've been around for a while and preached here a number of times in years gone by. And I'm trying to put the right names to the right faces to you people. And what do? The two people leading here and helping are both named Karen. You know, it's enough to try, send an old man about to absolutely bonkers. So I'll do my best. And go back to Claire's excellent overview of this gospel a fortnight ago, in which she looked at the problems. Yes, I didn't write it. I'm happy to honour the name of John. And John clearly wrote it, but which John? Well, I'm not going to take that up again. Karen, here we go. Claire took that apart a little bit, and I'm not going to drag it up again. I want to say straight away, I am not a theologian. I never have been. I'm a physicist turned schoolmaster who's picked up a little bit of theology along the road, but I don't claim to be a theologian. Basically, I'm still, in my mindset, a physicist who deals with facts and who finds that sometimes facts pose a problem, as the facts here certainly do. But this gospel of John is clearly, and Claire made that so clear, is much more than facts. It's basically a theological and philosophical reflection, I think. It seems pretty evident. It's the reflections of a long-term, aging disciple, thought probably to have written round about 90 AD, some 30 years after the other three synoptic gospels. And it seems to me, to a large extent, a deliberately purposeful philosophical reflection on the stories that John knows have been known and told and repeated. Let's get away from the silly idea that he was sitting there with three manuscripts in front of him, because until the invention of printing in 1450 by Gutenberg, it was just impossible to repeat documents like that. In the monastery area, they had scriptoria where scribes would listen to somebody dictating and they would write it down, and there might be 10 scribes, scribing monks, writing things down. Who knows whether they all wrote the same words down, whether they heard correctly. And in fact, there's been enormous study, wonderful study, to try and get us back to the original words as they were written, as far as the Gospels are concerned, 2,000 odd years ago, some of the other Old Testament documents long before that. And we are so privileged to have not only to have the documents in such ancient form, but with so much work being done. So my attitude is I take them as they stand, with the general philosophy of a physicist that the simplest, most elegant explanation is likely to be the true one. And I think that that was one of the dicta of my professor, I shall come back to, Professor Bragg, when I was at Cambridge. And he used to say that. I think it was the general philosophy, and still is, that if we want an explanation of something difficult, the true explanation is going to, in the end up, be relatively simple, the word relatively with strength, because some of the concepts, of course, are very involved. So my standpoint is simply that this is the writings of an old, one of the last surviving, I think, of the apostles, John, the son of Zebedee. There's only one John mentioned in this gospel, and it's clearly not himself, it's John the Baptist. There's a passing reference in 1:42 to Simon, son of John. So John, like many of the other names, Judas and all the rest of them, Jesus himself appears to be the same name as the Greek form of the name Joshua. So the number of names were not great, the forms sometimes were, but I take it simply the evidence seems to be this is John, the son of Zebedee, reflecting at the age of 90 on the things he knew had already been written and possibly needed adding to. I think we need to remember that, well, John probably, when he was walking the earth with Jesus, did not know how to read and write. Fishermen didn't. The only people who knew to read and write were the very specially educated people called scribes, who are referred to constantly in the New Testament and usually not very favorably. So, you know, my thought is he must have learned to read and write over all those years in order to write the letters he wrote. He may have had somebody to, he may have dictated them, somebody may have written them for him. He had an amanuensis, a scribe. That doesn't matter how we got the documents. I think we need to remember, however, that, and I won't use the word illiterate. I didn't say, see, he was illiterate, because the word illiterate carries a rather negative connotation. Pre-literate, non-literate, and Elkin last week referred to the learning in non-literate societies just in a passing reference. But the learning of the people in the synagogue, week after week after week, hearing the scriptures read, they knew their scriptures, even though they couldn't write them or read them. And we have to remember that they were not, in the negative, ignorant sense, illiterate. So, let's have a look at John and what he has to say. And I just want to say a little bit about the structure of the gospel, which seems to me to make sense. Now, can we project that? No, we can't. Need to move over just very slightly. So I know it's just about on the edge, that's all right. So John's gospel seems to be structured, and Claire referred to this, she said it's only one of the theories, but to me it's again the simple, elegant theory, and so I follow it as a physicist, although physicists know nothing about documents and so on. That's not quite true either. But it's interesting to look at the seven signs which seem to be the structure of John's gospel. There's a very important prologue beforehand, which Claire dealt with and I'll briefly refer to. And then there's these signs, and then there's the story of the crucifixion, roughly. And the signs are very interesting because only two of them are referred to in any of the other gospels. So you could say, well, maybe John was filling in the gaps. They need to hear about this. And then he chooses to repeat the feeding of the 5,000, which, because he uses it also, it's in all four Gospels. Why did he need to do that? And there is the story of walking on the water. The only one who doesn't refer to that is Dr. Luke, probably the most highest educated of the four Gospel writers. And he chooses to leave that out. I don't know whether he had difficulty with the science of it or what it was. but you can have your own theories. Which reminds me of another dictum of our professor. I must share it, because I think it's actually quite helpful. Professor Bragg, it was Lawrence Bragg, that was father and son, were both professors of physics at Cambridge, of course, well apart. And there was only one professor there in my time in the 40s. Today, I think there are 12. But there was just one professor of physics, and he was great with these dicta, these crunchy words. And one of them I remember very clearly. I can see him stomping up and down that lecture hall platform. Must have been in the second year, because there wouldn't have been enough third-year people doing physics to fill this lecture theatre. I could see it. And there he was saying, when you are stumped by an unanswerable question, as we often are, I'll tell you what you have to do. You've got to find a better question. That's a very profound statement, actually, and one that I found very helpful in many facets of life. So I'm really going to propose probably the better question with which to approach this whole question, the structure of John's Gospel. Why did he choose the particular things he chose? What is he trying to tell us? Because I think John was writing his Gospel as a reflection and saying, now there are things I really need to get through. And of course, you don't have to be very intelligent. You have to be a little bit attentive to what went on earlier in the service to know what the answer is. Because it's been made very obvious for me, and I've had my thunder stolen well and truly, but that's fine. And of course, it is made very clear in that long introduction. I was going to come back to it, but I think it's appropriate now. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made, without nothing. Without him nothing was made that was made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. And the light shines in the darkness. The darkness does not overcome it. I won't read all the rest, but the conclusion of that little section is, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. It seems that John is saying to you, look, I want to get home to you the truth of what we would call the doctrine of incarnation, that God was born of Mary as a full human being and also fully God. Now there's a brain stretch for you, isn't it? How on earth can one conceive of those two beings being one and coalesce? Really tough. And so, where does John go with this? He introduces a really, well, I think it's a rather unlikely story. Of course, the total abstainers would say it was a very unfortunate thing. It shouldn't have been there. But it was. And the fact was, of course, that you didn't drink water in those days because it was full of bugs. So what did you drink? You probably drank a common kind of ale. You certainly drank the wine that was produced in all the vineyards of Palestine and still is. So what does John record? Now, I want you to go with the story that was read to you. Thank you for reading so well and clearly. And I've only discovered just a new thing as I was meditating on this morning in the car, and I had to stop and look at it and say if I got it right. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there. But notice what follows. And Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. Now, one has to be very careful of adding two and two together and make about seven, which I'm not bad at doing sometimes. But his mother was there. They were invited. It seems that Mary had some very close relationship with this household in Cana. Cana's experts still arguing exactly where it was, but it appears to have been some, here's the old school coming up, 7 or 8 miles from Nazareth. But she was there. They were invited. I think this John, I think he did these things purposely. And he's suggesting that while they were guests, I think she must have been part of the household, part of the family, in some connection, knew them well. We get that also because, well, let's go on with the story. Set the picture. I want you to imagine yourself in this room and all these people were there, a large crowd. It may not even have been a room, it may have been outside somewhere. And this gathering, and the wine runs out. Total disaster. How did Mary know? That would be the sort of thing that the host might know, or the head housekeeper, slave, whatever they were. We don't know. But she knew. So she was, I think she was part of the sort of hosting family in some way. And what does she do? I think this is very significant. She turns to Jesus. She doesn't ask him to do anything. She just states a fact. They've run out of wine. I wonder if there's a little lesson there for me, perhaps for all of us. We're a bit inclined to shape our prayers in a form that tells God what we think he ought to do. I think it's a better habit to, not that we need to share the fact with him because he's all-knowing anyway, but the acknowledgement of a need. And as the commentators are all pretty quick to say, the translation, woman, why do you involve me? The very word woman gives a sort of harsh tone to it. I think our phrase would be, dear lady, why involve me? Except that was his mother. Mother dear, why involve me? Something like that. I want you to imagine what relationships were like in that Nazareth home. Here is Jesus, the eldest brother. We know he had four brothers. They're all named twice. Sisters didn't get named, but there were at least two because they're named in the plural. There were probably more. So it was quite a large family. And Jesus says, well, he actually says, my time, my hour has not yet come. So this is a story that just very closely in time precedes his launching of himself publicly. And there's only one other story in between the babyhood and Jesus' public ministry, and that's, of course, the one in the temple when he disappears and is found dialoguing with all the learned people. It's all we have of the relationship of Jesus with his mother. What did she know? Well, we know what she knew. She'd been told by the angel that he was going to be the one who would deliver Israel, that he was going to be, in the terms that came to be common, the Messiah, the Savior. Can you picture it? It's really, the more I've done so in the last couple of weeks, I may say I've never preached on this subject before, on this story before, and it's been wonderful to discover it and to realize what it's telling us about the earthly family of Jesus. We're actually told quite specifically in John chapter 7 that his brothers did not yet believe in him, or not believe in him, whatever it means. But Mary knew. Can you sort of sense the tension? So there it is. I think John is very deliberately has chosen this story because it illustrates in a very graphic way these two incompatible truths, that Jesus was fully man, fully human, and yet he was also the Son of God. And this story illustrates it. And what does he do? All Jesus does, and you'll notice in the story, actually, it's interesting just to contemplate what went on in the mind of the servants, because it was Mary who told the servants, do what he tells you. And what did Jesus tell them to do? Just go and get some water from these huge jars, which are for ceremonial washing and so on. Probably the same servants had filled them from the well earlier. Oh no, actually it says, Jesus tells them to go and fill them, so they must have done it then and there. And they just filled it. And Jesus said, now take some and take it to the host. And I can just imagine the servant thinking, boy, there's going to be trouble here. I'm going to keep out of this. And I can imagine him taking the wine to the host and drawing aside as discreetly as he could. And to his shock, the host exclaimed, you're a weird fellow. Normally people keep the best wine, use the best wine first, and when people have had a bit too much, then anything goes. And you've kept up, this is beautiful, where did this come from? I wonder, of course you've got to remember there were vineyards all over the place. So the wine, I imagine, normally served would have been this neighbor's and this friend and this relative's and so on. Who produced this beautiful wine? It's really, the mind boggles. My mind boggles still. Now, the question I want, the better question that I want you to think about, and I'll serve you a warning so you can be thinking. I think rather than stop and have a discussion before we all go and have a cup of tea, I'd like to just pause and invite your comments. We've got a mic to hand round, have we? Good, okay. And I'd like us just to pause and think about how does this, putting it in this rather unexplained way. Well, I think there's no way of coping with two incompatible truths than to say they're both true. That's what a physicist does. So these two incompatible truths, are both true. What does it say to you? What does it mean to your life? Yes, some of the questions that I haven't got those questions in front of me anymore. Karen number one. Hall. But I'd like you to just ask, how does it affect you in the way in which you live for Jesus, with Jesus? Because it is Christ in me, the hope of glory, that is this wonderful truth for us today. Right. Who's game to start the discussion? Tell us what you feel is the key thing about this story. We've got somebody at the back there. Thanks. Oh.
I just have to start by asking, why is it that you see the divine and the human as incompatible? Why would fully human and fully divine not be fully and flowingly compatible with one another?
You're putting me on the spot. I wasn't intending anything. Give me time to think about that. Karen, I think, has got a hand up.
This is just a response to Ken. In one way, that could be a need to ask a different question. Or, on the other hand, that can be the diversity of how the story is felt. For something I wanted to try and draw out to the children, that these stories for some people are of Jesus incarnate produce the absolute certainty that is the foundation of their faith, that the divine and the earthly are inextricably bound, and for others it's a great mystery.
I'm not looking for an answer from you, actually.
Don't expect one, and not a simple one. But I will come back to you just the same.
No worries.
Yes, sir.
John, one thing that I don't understand, that I guess I'm reading a lot in Richard Rohr's work, is the notion of Jesus the Christ, and Christ being eternal, the eternal expression of God, and Jesus is the man taking on that role, in a sense, Jesus as the Christ, and that Christ is the eternal, godly, godlike element of Jesus the human. That's how I'm seeing it at the moment. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I have to have thoughts on it. Would anybody else like to throw something in before? Yes.
Thanks, John. I'd like to rephrase Ken's question rather than as a question and simply say, personally, I believe that the God and the human are compatible, and that that's what God originally intended when he created human beings, and Jesus is God's way of bringing us back to what he originally intended.
I think that's rather a good statement. Thank you. You are a wonderful group, you know, the comments that come out. That's why I wanted to do this.
You usually can't shut us up once we start. I suppose what that particular miracle would say to me, and it always surprises me when I meet people who say God's not interested in the day-to-day things of life, is that there's nothing too small and mundane to interest God. But the other thing I would get from it is it's okay for us all to drink wine.
Well, thank you. You've stolen my thunder very nicely, because I've actually got written down here that Jesus is concerned with the mundane. And I think it's a very good example of him wanting to be part of our mundane life. Let's go on round.
Yeah, probably echoing the same sort of thought that that God is involved, is concerned with us. I mean, that's the heart of the incarnation.
Yes.
So on the one hand, there is a time for things. God has a plan, a purpose. As told in the prophecy, etc., etc., etc. You know, there is a time. And when Jesus goes, hang on, it's not my time yet, and his mother goes, just do what he tells you. And so, you know, God incarnate goes, all right, whatever. And this is the way God works with us, is that that we are... we don't do things according to the plan, and God's okay with that.
Yeah.
And we don't have to do everything exactly right. He'll work with the situation. That's fine. And there's a few other places in John's Gospel where you get the flavour of things not being perfect in the first instance, and that's I think that tells us something about our relationship with God and how it works.
Yep. Thank you. Here we've got one, two. Peter.
Just reflecting that when Jesus does this kind of thing, he has a tendency to go overboard, with providing food or providing wine. And in this case, from what we know, he produced hundreds of gallons of wine. And I've often wondered what Cana in Galilee looked like the next morning.
there's another unanswerable question.
The thought that came to me as I was listening to all that is, I love Henry Nouwen's book called Compassion, where he talks about this, well, not the miracle, but thought was, if John was writing in the context partly of the Gnostic kind of heresy that we're being saved to be spiritual, then this is about saying no, and what Nouwen says in Compassion, he says the secret of the incarnation, this is my experience, is that God is not, that we want to be saved from our life and our suffering, and that this is saying no, the gospel, God joins us in our life, and God joins us in our suffering, so he embodies the human, he doesn't save us to some spirituality.
I think there's one over here. I think we'll have to draw it to a close after these two.
Sorry, this one's not actually philosophical, it's more historical. You mentioned that the possibility that this is a familial, maybe Mary's sister's wedding, son's wedding or whatever, so it was a family connection. And it strikes me that there are servants involved and they are the servants of the family. Yeah. And so that, to me, brings a direct challenge to my notion that Jesus comes from a poor background. Maybe Jesus was an upper middle class person. Maybe he actually had time to go to the scriptures. He didn't need to work. That the position that he came from was not the portrayed manger scene, but more of a different class. That's what I got out of what you were saying.
And, of course, the little we're told about those things makes you quite free to consider that. Go on.
Just riffing off what Michael said, that idea that Jesus is with us in our suffering, but he's also with us at our weddings. Yes. And our celebrations. Absolutely. And our joy. And that's also a really important part of his incarnation.
Yes. And I think... One more. You're going to close the service. You can have your say at the end.
It was, again, just a thought coming from Michael's statements. I think the thing that struck me the most wasn't an either-or, but both, when I kept looking at this story, and it was that God is here to save us from our suffering, but he's also here with us in our suffering. And it is incompatible that God is human, but it's not. That's what I kept being struck with, and that's where I found... I couldn't sit on either side of the fence. I found myself wanting to go both ways and somehow trying to understand that.
I think that... Oh. Okay. One more. Oh, yes.
John, I'm so pleased to hear you speak this morning. It's been a real privilege, and I'm blown away that you were lectured by Sir Lawrence Bragg. I don't think I heard anything else after that statement. But I'm so impressed. A question for you. I don't have trouble with magic. Jesus doesn't have to prove himself to be a supernatural being. So I don't have, per se, trouble with turning water into wine. But I've always wondered, are these stories a little gratuitous? Why, if they're unique to John, and John would, of all people, know that he doesn't need to include these stories to prove who Jesus was. And in fact, Jesus himself said, even if you believe someone rose from the dead, that wouldn't cut it. So, and maybe this question has already been answered, but I'd love to hear from you. Why do you think, and this is speculation, why do you think John included this story?
Well, the best I can answer, and it's interesting how we keep coming back to your original question, Ken. I think, again, supposition, but a lot of people think that John, as he wrote the Gospel, probably finished at the end of what is now chapter 20, and that 21 may have been added by somebody very soon afterwards. But he actually tells us, Jesus performed many other signs and so on, which are not recorded in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Now, that text in itself has been the cause of a lot of argument, because the believing can be taken in two ways. Does it mean you will come to faith, or does it mean you will adhere to the faith you've inherited? And that's the unanswerable question. We don't have any way of telling the answer to that. It could mean either or both. But John clearly chose these things to lead people to faith, to strengthen their faith, one or both. And that was his reason for choosing. And I think that all the other things that have been said, I'm sure there is, this story is often used, of course, in wedding services, and I think it's a good one, because it does bring the stained glass Jesus out of the stained glass window, right down to what's in front of us on the board, and the celebration of the toast and so on. And I think that's good. So that's, I think the story does do that. Yes, it raises a question. I think it was you, Peter, who raised the question, what happened to the rest of the water that had been turned into wine? Was it still water? Or did it become wine as it was picked up? Who knows? And those are the unanswerable questions. The better question is the one we're on. Why did John, what did he want to convey? Because that's why we're reading the Gospel, isn't it? Don't we want to hear what John is saying to us through his Gospel? And I think that he is saying, and if we go back to Ken's question, why I have a problem is that I am so conscious of my own failing humanity that I find it hard to conceive what it would be like to be free to choose evil, but never have done so, never have been able to do so, because he was God himself. Now that is a deep concept that I don't know that I'm capable of grasping in my limited human mind. And I come back at the end in all these sorts of dialogues with saying, why do I need to explore this? Am I in fact guilty of Adam's sin of wanting to be God? Because I think that's what the essence of Adam's sin was. He wanted to have control. He wanted to know everything. And I think there's a tendency for, and I think it's behind. Help. that taught me it ought to finish it anyway from the time point of view. But so I think that there is an element of Adam's rebellion in the garden, that's what it was, that makes us say, we've got to be able to grasp all this. If I could grasp all this, then I would be God, and I can't. And I have to say, to me, the two truths are not compatible because I know my own fallibility. And I find it hard to conceive how in a fallible body like mine, God could be incarnate. But he was. And my physics training makes it no difficulty whatever to say, well, that's all right, too bad, it's a fact. And there it is.